welcome to another episode of my show. I'm Father Roderick, podcasting from the heart of the Netherlands, the beautiful city of Amersfoort, where it's currently, I don't know, 25 degrees Celsius? Crazy hot. But that doesn't prevent me from recording another show for you. Right before I started recording, we had a little conversation with people in the chat room, and in the northern part of the United States, where we have listeners, it's already getting chilly. I saw the first photos of I think from Canada, and certain parts of Canada, it has already snowed, which actually happened also 3 years ago around this time of year in the Netherlands. Right now, we have a crazy summer. It is unbelievably hot. And I'm really hoping that temperatures will go down, because next week on Sunday, I have to run a marathon. And it's the Marathon of Amsterdam. It was known for its cool weather, flat surface, so a relatively easy marathon. But I know from experience, from having run a marathon in Rotterdam, my last marathon actually was 25 degrees Celsius. And I almost didn't finish. That's how hard it was. It's, when you're running, you're generating all this extra heat. And when the ambient temperatures are also very high, it's very hard to get rid of that heat, no matter how much you drink. So I'm really hoping that things will cool down right now. I'm in a relatively cool studio right here. And because, well, everybody's talking about the weather right now, let's also go to the news and talk a little bit more about weather.
Do you know what's going on? This is what's happening in your world.
Face it, Catholics rule. We got Boston, South America, the good part of Ireland, and we're making serious inroads in Mozambique, baby.
You've taken your first step into a larger world.
So Judy is from Minneapolis, and she says, we have snow showers right here now. And Mike Kuipers is in the area, kind of in the same direction of Chicago, 45 degrees Fahrenheit. So that's pretty chilly. the reason that a lot of people are talking about these crazy temperatures, and also about these ever-increasing dangerous storms and hurricanes and whatnot. And there was a lot of attention for the news report. You've undoubtedly heard about it. That came from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. They released a report that they started to work on a couple of years ago, and it was basically a scientific examination of what the accords of the Paris Agreement would have for an effect. As you know, in 2015, a lot of countries came together in Paris and decided to take action to combat global warming. And so at the time, a lot of countries were promising pretty drastic measures to keep the increase of the temperature below 1.5 degrees in degrees Celsius. Because that's we're currently, every year the Earth's temperatures are rising, and so this report was trying to from all sorts of disciplines to predict what would happen if the temperature would rise to another 1.5 degrees. Apparently, the terms that were agreed in Paris in 2015 are no longer sufficient to limit climate change. And there was, I've linked to an article in the show notes from the Weather Channel that gives a very good scientific overview of what we can expect. And this is only if we manage to keep it to 1.5 degrees. The report also says that actually, if the current behavior worldwide does not change, we'll go way beyond 1.5 degrees in 2030. We'll overshoot it to I think 2.5 degrees Celsius. Now, the good news is it is still possible to halt these changes, but it will require very, very harsh measures, especially when it comes to changing our energy consumption from, you know, having it be coal, oil-based, like fossil fuels, and moving towards cleaner energy forms like wind energy. That the Netherlands is big on wind energy, solar energy, etc., etc. The question, of course, is: will we all do that, or are we always, as you see, most often that the economy comes first, and people are always trying to downplay the results. And well, it's not going to be that bad. And if temperatures are high, well, we'll just crank up the air conditioning a little bit more. What we always forget is that the first victims of these climate changes are not the people in the rich countries. They can always figure out ways to keep their temperatures low in their houses, etc., and continue their lifestyle. Where the real problems occur is usually in the countries where you don't have that many television crews walking around. It's the people that live in the third world countries, in poorer, underdeveloped countries, where not only they suffer because of the temperatures, but it's because of these temperature changes. Also, the entire agriculture changes, and also drought, for instance, can make it much harder to grow food for large portions of the world. We've seen these increasing hurricanes and the weather problems that are causing many people to die. And it's not just the people that die immediately from a hurricane or from a storm. But it's also in the aftermath when, you know, that it's because of all these changes, it's much more difficult to recover from disasters like that. And it's only a matter of time until we also in our more developed, richer countries are becoming the victim of these climate changes that could become irreversible. Now, what I always advocate is focus on the science. Focus on the scientists. Don't go with the fear mongers, but also don't fall too easily for the people that say, "Well, actually, this is all rubbish." And you know what? Isn't it presumptuous to think that we small creatures here on this planet Earth can change this big, big planet and change the climate? I would say, This is a consensus among scientists, and look at the scientific approach of that, and also ask yourself, what can I do to make things better? And don't think that you're just one person. Where this entire world is made up of individuals that can make choices, and we can change the economy, we can change the countries in which we live by our individual choices, and of course by also trying to advocate another lifestyle to people around us. But the best way to do that is by showing example, the right example. And for instance, I'm rethinking my own lifestyle when it comes, for instance, to the amount of plastic that I consume. Of course, I'm not eating plastic, but the stuff that I buy, it's always wrapped in plastic. And it's just such a habit to go for the cheaper products. But I also know a number of people, and I'm following a number of people that are on Facebook, on Instagram, that are really leading the way for me, showing me that it's also possible to reduce that footprint that I have in terms of all this plastic, but also the energy that I consume. And it's made out of these tiny decisions. And always the main question is, what do I truly need in my life? Do I need all that plastic? Is there an alternative? Another thing for me is reconsidering the amount of travel that I do and also the form of travel. Of course, nowadays you can get these very cheap flights, but one airplane causes so much more pollution than I would cause by just driving around in my car. So it's kind of, you know, if you say one thing, like I want to take my bike more often because it's better for the environment, then I should ask myself, I should think not only twice, but 10 times before I take an airplane to go to a destination. And there are other ways to discover the world. I can take a bike. I can walk. I mean, one of the most impressive journeys that I made in my life was done on foot. It was for 40 days. And yeah, it took me a while to get to Santiago, but it is a much better way to experience nature, to experience cities and life, if you just slow down. So lots and lots of choices that I can make to contribute to this. And if we all do that, over time, we may be able to preserve the Earth and its resources for future generations. And I think it's not just an option. I think it is a moral obligation that we do that. And it's even spiritually good for us if we ask ourselves this basic question, you know, if God gave us this Earth, how do I handle this? Is it just everything for me? Am I just thinking of myself? Or can I live a lifestyle that actually preserves the resources of this planet and the beauty of the world in which we live for future generations? It's a big question, but it starts with small steps. And with that...
How do you not like movies?
They're predictable. Like, the guy gets the girl and that kid sees dead people and Darth Vader is Luke's father.
Not liking movies is like not liking puppies.
They're fine. I just get bored and never make it to the end.
You know, you need a movie education. You need a moviecation. I'm going to give it to you.
It is time for our movies and TV segment. And there's a lot to enjoy on television. Actually, I'm not really watching television at all. I'm always watching Netflix or Amazon Prime, because there's enough for me to discover there. In my new rectory, in a few weeks from now, I'll be moving to the village of Hooglanderveen. Try pronouncing that if you're not from the Netherlands, Hooglanderveen, which is much farther away from my movie theater. And I'm still paying this monthly fee to be able to watch movies whenever I want and no matter how many I want. And more, I'm discovering that I actually really don't care that much anymore for watching the movies when they're in theaters, because there is so much else to watch on just the streaming platforms. And I'm thinking that if I'm even further away from the movie theater, I probably will go to the movies even less than I do now. And so it's cheaper for me to, if there is the, you know, one or two movies once in a while that I want to see, to just buy a ticket than to continue paying this monthly fee. Speaking of Netflix, I finished the Jack Ryan series on Amazon Prime. I thought it was an excellent first season. It was kind of a more muted ending to the first season. I expected something a bit more spectacular, but then I'm thinking it's just a TV show, but it feels like a movie. That's how well it is done. But I really enjoyed it. Can't wait for season two. And that freed up some time for me to go back to Netflix and continue watching Doctor Who. Now, you know that just the other week, the BBC started showing the 11th season of Doctor Who, featuring a female doctor. And I really, really want to see those new episodes. But before that, I need to finish season 10, which has just been posted to Netflix here in Europe. And it's the last season with Peter Capaldi, which is so far one of my favorite doctors. And it's really good. I enjoyed this whole transition from from Clara, the companion of the doctor in season, I think it was 7, 8, and 9. She's been there quite a while. And I really loved the way in which they showed how the doctor is trying to handle grief and having to say goodbye. Because one of the problems of the doctor, it's kind of similar to the elves in Tolkien's world, is they live for thousands of years. And so there's always a certain innate sadness to their lives, because everything around them and everyone around them is dying, is falling away. And they will have to find new companions all the time because they live for so long. Same thing for the elves in Tolkien's world in Middle Earth. They live forever unless they're killed. But they don't die naturally. And so there is this sadness that the world around them is in decay. And especially in The Lord of the Rings, of course, when you go to Rivendell, everything is in fall colors. It's not just pretty. It's because it's a symbol of what the elves experience. It's everything is dying. The evil is taking over Middle Earth. And they are going to journey. They're going to move away from Middle Earth, which pains them tremendously. And then you've got in the movies, of course, the story of Arwen, which is based on Beren and Luthien's story of this elf that loses basically the rights to eternal life by getting involved with Aragorn and basically giving up eternity, because the alternative is to seeing the man that she loves die and then to survive him, and she doesn't want that. So in The Doctor, you also have that same theme of the finite character of our human existence, and then this alien, the Doctor is an alien, who has a much bigger lifespan. And then, so what do you do when you have to say goodbye to a companion that you loved and cared for? And so, well, I thought it was a really good solution that they found for portraying this transition from one companion to another. I was really curious how they would solve this, because it's not just the Doctor who is mourning. It's also the audience who, when you watch a TV show for a couple of years, you get attached to all these characters. You don't want them to die or to go away. But then, of course, a TV show also has to renew itself. The Doctor, they can do that by, you know, this regeneration of the Doctor every 3 or 4 years. With the companions, it's usually, well, either a companion dying or a companion just walking away. And so I'm not sure what I think of the new companion yet. It's a new character, very different from the Clara character, and I'm really having trouble adjusting to this new style. But I kind of trust the writers. And there was this one episode, I think it was the pilot episode of the season 10, where it's an homage to the superhero movies, in especially in the American culture. And I thought it was really, really well done. And I was curious to hear what our friends over at SQPN thought of it, because they have a show that is dedicated to Doctor Who. It's called Secrets of Doctor Who. But I was looking in the feed, in the podcast feed of that show, and they only had the last 15 or 20 episodes. Because they're the hosts of that show are living in the United States, they are one season ahead of me. And so I couldn't find the old episodes. I asked Dom to if he could solve that. So he opened up the RSS feed and added back a lot of the older episodes, so I can now actually enjoy. It's kind of, that's one of the wonders of podcasting. It's this delayed distribution. They recorded this more than a year ago, and I get to listen to it as if it was recorded yesterday, and I can enjoy this all their commentaries on this 10th season. So highly recommend it. It's a really good discussion that they have in general. And of course, Jimmy Akin is part of the panel, and he is a Doctor Who uber expert. He knows really so many details, which makes it more enjoyable to watch this series, because by listening to the podcast as a companion, it's almost like a meta companion to the viewer and to the Doctor Who fan. It makes you appreciate the series even more. I've got one more tip for you, and that's a movie tip, and that has to do with the news of this week. This week started with the canonization on Sunday by Pope Francis of two new saints. Archbishop Oscar Romero, who is the first Salvadoran saint from El Salvador. So, and the second canonization was that of Pope Paul VI. I'll talk a little bit more about Paul VI in the Peculiar Bunch segment. But Oscar Romero is another great man who, let me give you a bit of the of his life. The highlights of his life. He was born on August 15, beautiful day, in 1917, and he became a priest and later on a bishop, and more was touched by the suffering of his people. Of course, El Salvador was involved in a very violent local war, or national war, a civil war, I should say, which was very bloody. And also the United States tried to influence the outcome of that war by subsidizing certain parties. And Romero was always very outspoken against any military oppression of both sides. He wanted to be with the people and wanted to put an end to the bloodshed in that country. One of his messages and one of the things he said right before dying was, you know, don't kill your own people. And he said that to both parties in that war. It's you're killing the farmers. You're killing your own brothers and sisters and your own children. Stop doing that. And he was becoming more and more outspoken. According to some, he was way too close to the Marxists that were fighting. But that's actually not true. He was also opposed to the violence that the Marxists used to change. And I think that his approach was very much a spiritual one. It's you got to change on the inside. You have to seek peace. And only if you seek peace for the right reasons, not to just gain power or gain political or economical influence, but if you seek it because of for the sake of the people that live in that country, that's the only way to real lasting peace. And I think he was right in that. But it cost him his life. He was at one point celebrating mass at a hospital in a chapel in 1980. On March the 24th, and he had just delivered a homily, and we actually know what he was preaching about, and it was very much kind of going to the core of his message. And then he was gunned down. He was actually killed by a bullet in the heart during mass. He died as a martyr. And one of his last words that we know from the people that were there at Mass was, "One must not love oneself so much as to avoid getting involved in the risks of life that history demands of us, and those who fend off danger will lose their lives." It's almost as if he was aware of the fact that he was going to die a martyr. Pope Francis considered him a saint and a martyr for many years, even way before he became Pope. He was already in interviews. He was talking about Romero, and he's like, you know, if I were Pope, what a crazy idea. But if I were Pope right now, he would already have been a saint. It's crazy. But it was Pope Benedict XVI. He was the one. Also, Pope Paul VI, who was in, you know, had good contacts with Archbishop Romero. But it was Benedict XVI, who, against also a lot of opposition, even in his own curia, started the process of canonization and played a major role in getting everything done. But it's a really, I think, momentous occasion. That it's Pope Francis who has in many ways a similar message to Archbishop Romero, who has pronounced this canonization of this great saint, who is now revered in the entire in the global Catholic Church. It's a great man. But why am I talking about this in the movie segment? Well, there is a movie based on his life that is made in 1989. It is a movie that I saw for the first time when I was still studying media in Rome. And one of our teachers, showed us this movie during class. We're doing film analysis and everything, so we were watching several movies that were made on live saints. Some of them were made, for instance, by EWTN or by, you know, these Italian Catholic channels, and a lot of them were very sappy and so, you know, rose-colored, and all these saints were always beautiful people. You know, the actors were five times as beautiful as the original saints, and they were always like talking in a very saintly, very pious and devout manner. And you know, he showed us this movie about Romero's life to show you that it's also possible to do something that is much more realistic and also has, you know, a real impact on the viewer. And I remember especially those scenes where he's gunned down while he is celebrating the Eucharist made a huge impression on me, because that was the first time that I realized, you know, martyrs are not just people from ages, centuries ago. There are modern day martyrs. And that priest, that message that got him killed is the same message that I'm called to preach in my country. Am I ready to be a martyr? Am I willing to give my life for the message that I preach? Because what happened to him can happen to me also. I'm not hoping so. I'm not really volunteering for that. But are you aware of the fact that the life that you live as a priest and the mission that has been given to you by God could cost you your life. The movie came very close to home all of a sudden. And you're actually able to watch this movie online. Again, I will include a link in the show notes. It's on gloria.tv. It's subtitled, I think, in Hindi. So the subtitles, don't look at the subtitles. You won't be able to read them anyway, or most of you won't be able to. But the movie itself is in English, and it's a VHS copy. So it's the same copy that I watched back then in Rome. But it's really good. It's a really impressive movie, and I recommend you watching it so that, you know, if you've only heard about Romero or you've only picked up some stuff from the news, watching a movie that is done as well as this movie will make that saint come alive, strangely enough, even though he died. But it will make, I think, his message have much more pertinence and become more, I don't know, close to home. That's what it did to me. So I'd invite you to check that out. The link is in the show notes on tridio.com.
When did you become an expert in thermonuclear astrophysics?
Last night. The packet. The extraction theory papers. Am I the only one who did the reading?
All right, books. I am reading a book, or actually I'm listening to a book that I'm really enjoying. It has been on my, you know, top 10 list of books that I wanted to read this year. It's Artemis by Andy Weir. Of course, Andy Weir, the author of The Martian, one of my favorite books of all time. I love the books, love the movie as well. And this was the first, not a sequel, but the first next book in his series. And again, it's taking place in the world of astronomy and colonization of, in this case, not a planet, not Mars, but our own moon. It takes place in the future, just like The Martian. I'm thinking from the description of the events that it's a little bit more in the future than The Martian was, but I don't know, it could be contemporary. The situation is the planet, our planet, is, well, as usual, it's a bit overcrowded. You've got rich people and they want to spend their vacation on another blob in the universe. And so Mars is a little bit too far away, but the moon is actually a quite nice destination for a lot of these richer tourists. And so they built a big base on the moon, and it's the base that is called Artemis. It looks from the outside, from the descriptions, just like, you know, what a moon base was depicted as in our, you know, 60s and 70s science fiction movies. It's a bunch of half domes that are interconnected by these big corridors. They're slightly bigger than what I remember from those science fiction movies. And those domes are basically small cities. And it's not just the domes, but they have dug underground several levels deep. They have hotels, they've got shops, but they also have industry. For instance, they make the glass. Any glass that you see in on Artemis is made locally because there are plenty of resources. Also, no problem whatsoever with oxygen, because they can generate oxygen by extracting it from the materials on the moon. The only downside is it creates a lot of heat that they somehow need to dissipate. Well, the way it's written, it's classic Andy Weir. There's a lot of scientific information in this. Everything that he talks about, even though it is technically speaking science fiction because it hasn't happened yet, but it's still scientifically researched and everything. And so while you're reading this adventure, you also learn a lot about science and about the moon and about, you know, how if in the future we ever want to live there, what does that entail? And one of the things, I haven't finished the book yet, so I'm not sure how the story will evolve, but I'm really hooked. It's, by the way, it's the audio, the Audible version is really good. The main character is a woman in this case. It's also read by a woman who is really great at doing all these accents. And the main protagonist is from the Middle East, I think, from Saudi Arabia. So she does an accent like that, but there are also African women in there, and she does it. She nails a lot of those accents really, really well. It makes it more, it sounds like you're watching a movie. That's what I love about the audiobook. But there's this one scene that I, when I was listening to it, it was like, wow, I love that. I didn't know that. And it's about coffee. And it's one of the reasons why I probably wouldn't really like it on the moon. And that has to do with the low pressure inside those domes. It's a lower pressure than here on Earth. And as a result, coffee is undrinkable on the moon. Because, why is that? And he explains it. The water, if you have lower pressure, will start to boil earlier than on Earth. So here in my house, water boils at 100 degrees Celsius. In a lower pressure environment, it will start to boil already at 80 degrees Celsius instead of 100. And coffee that is made with 80 degree boiling water is not good. It's really not good. You know, imagine like coffee that you let cool down too much and you drink it and you're like, yuck, oh, that's not warm enough. Well, that's kind of why a lot of people are complaining about the coffee on the moon. And Andy Weir was so surprised that that was the one paragraph in his book, because it's only a throwaway moment in the story. But almost everyone that has read the book has reacted to that in the comments, in the reviews. And he, in an interview, he says, it's so funny that one little line, I've gotten so much feedback on that. People are like, well, you could make the coffee in a pressure cooker, or you could cold brew it. There are a lot of options here. And people are happy to do the suspension of disbelief to go into Artemis. But by God, they won't give up their coffee. You know what? If you love coffee, that is totally understandable. So I'm really enjoying this book. It's very different from The Martians, also very different type of main character. There's language in the book. There are some mature themes, more than in The Martian. But in its core, it's a really riveting story, supported with a lot of science. And that makes it, to me, a really great, recommendable book. So go check it out. Oops, that's the wrong one. I wanted to press this button, The Peculiar Bunch.
Catholics rock!
Oh, and I forgot to change the backgrounds. I should have had books behind me on the live stream. And now it's too late. I gotta move to the Holy Spirit.
The Peculiar Bunch? No meat on Friday.
No meat? What did I eat, light bulbs?
Thank goodness for the chat room for reminding me to change the green screen background.
Man, you guys got more crazy rules than Blockbuster Video.
This is the segment where we talk about faith and things going on in the Catholic world. Before I move on, I want to say hi to Lisa Marie in the chat room, who is saying, I miss your Farmville podcast. Well, kudos to you, Lisa Mary. You're one of the few people that still remembers these old and these ancient podcasts that we used to do. And one I did about Farmville, that was this online game on Facebook where you had to plant your cabbages and your tomatoes and harvest them. And it was a huge time sink, but it was fun while it lasted. I don't think it's around anymore, at least not that I know. And I even don't want to know if it's around anymore because, you know, been there, done that. Hey, let's talk about the canonization of Paul VI, which also happened on the same Sunday that Archbishop Romero was canonized. Paul VI was the pope that I knew as a child. He had been appointed or chosen a pope in, I think, 63. I was born in 1968. And he died on August the 6th in 1978. I was 10 years old. And I actually remember that pope. I saw him on television. We had this black and white television. My parents were very involved Catholics in the parish. So whenever the pope came on the news, we would watch that. And my parents would explain what a pope was, etc. So for me, the pope was Paul VI. And I remember the day that he died, well, the evening that the news was announced. I was playing with my brother in my brother's room, and my father entered the room with a pretty, you know, he was serious, you could tell. And he said, as the Pope died, and it's on television right now. And so we were like, what? The Pope died? What? I wasn't even aware that popes could die. And I also remember after the conclave, the moment that his successor was presented on the balcony, Pope John Paul I, and then the sadness when we heard that Pope died after 30 days, and then John Paul II. So I three popes in a very, very short amount of time made a huge impression on me as a 10-year-old boy. I didn't know, of course, what this Pope did. You would only see him at Easter and at Christmas time, and we would come back from Mass, and then we would give the blessing on the balcony, and we would all cross ourselves in front of the television. That's the only thing that I saw of Pope Paul VI. And of course, later on, when I started to study theology and church history, that's when you start to realize how important Pope Paul VI has been. He was the second Pope of Vatican II, this major event in the Catholic Church, started by John the 23rd, who was canonized 2 years ago, I think, but who didn't really live to see the end of that huge, important process for the Church. Instead, it was Pope Paul VI, who was a good theologian, was already working for a long time as a bishop inside and as a cardinal inside the Vatican itself. He was one of the main advisors also to Pope John the 23rd. And when he was elected, he also inherited this process of Vatican II, and he played a major role in bringing that to a good end. And a lot of the conclusions of the Second Vatican Council were also, I think, influenced by his own insistence on, for instance, the dialogue with the modern world. One of the reasons that Pope John the 23rd started Vatican II was he wanted the Church to open the windows to the world that had changed. And so if you want to reach the world, you have to learn the language of the world. And the only way to do that is to engage the world. And Pope Paul the VI had that same impetus to go out there and meet the people where they are. We always think that John Paul II was the Pope who traveled the world and went to all these different countries. But actually, Pope John Paul II only continued what Paul VI had started. He was one of the first popes to make traveling to all these different regions where the Catholic Church lived and breathed, to go there and to, instead of asking people to come to Rome, he would go and visit his flock in all these different countries. And so there are many photos and footage that we have from all these different travels. And for him, it was one of the ways in which you could show as a church that you wanted to enter into a dialogue with all these different cultural expressions of the Catholic faith in these different countries in the world. And Pope John Paul II and also now Pope Francis have just followed that example. Pope Paul VI, and you probably also hear that in the news around this canonization, was also very well known because of an encyclical letter that he wrote, which was called Humanae Vitae, about our human life. In which he took a very firm stance against contraception, sterilization, and abortion. It was a controversial encyclical letter around this whole process of Vatican II. There was a lot of people, a lot of theologians also, with all the advances made in this artificial contraceptive methods, who were asking themselves, well, perhaps the Church should change its position, and perhaps we should just go along with these developments in culture. And Paul VI, after having, of course, consulted all these theologians, having thought and prayed about it, said, no, we're going to stay firm on this. The Catholic teaching prohibits contraception. Of course, and also emphasize there are natural ways that the Lord has given us to still, in a certain way, regulate the amount of children in a family, but it's with always this openness to life and to this life-giving giving act that sexuality is supposed to be. You know, let alone abortion as a, you know, that's not even contraception. It's just killing a human being. That's how the church looks at life. It starts at conception. And so he took a firm stance, knowing very well that it would be controversial. And in those days, in those years, I think there was even much more upheaval about it than nowadays. And so he knew that he was going to take a hit from writing this, but then again, he was like, I believe this to be the truth. I believe this is the message that God asks us to proclaim. And so we should do that regardless of how popular it will be or how much opposition we will get. And in many ways, I think that that encyclical letter was prophetic. I think that we are, in a way, we have evolved a lot when it comes to what we know about the impact of contraception and about all this chemical upheaval that it causes in people. And I think also in when it comes to the natural family planning techniques, all that we've learned so much. And I wonder if that would have evolved so much if it hadn't been for this stance that Paul VI took at that time. And it was not just this pope. It was, of course, the entire church. But it's the pope that makes it doctrine. And so, and one of the things that he was warning for, because you know, a lot of people talk about Humanae Vitae, but they've never read it. And so that's one of the big lessons that I've learned as a theologian is, don't talk about something if you don't know what you're talking about. First, do the research, read it. And then you start to discover what is actually beneath that stance. It's not just an opposition. It's not just against something. It is this prohibition of contraception is to protect something that's much more valuable and much more important to safeguard. And it's life itself. It's the way God created us and the way He intended us to live out our lives and the way we interact with each other, including our sexuality. One of the things that Paul VI warned against when it comes to contraception was, you know, if it becomes so easy to stop people from having children, it becomes possible for governments also to use those means to force people to use contraception. And this was said and written down years before China actually implemented this and started to force people to have only one child. And the catastrophic consequences of that one-child policy in China, there is so much suffering and so much horrific violence that is hidden from view because we never hear it. And they only show happy people on television. But I've been to China. I've heard the stories of people that had multiple abortions because they wanted to have a boy, because that was a much safer investment. Talking about corrupting our human interactions. A boy was much more important for the parents and for the grandparents than a girl. And so it's unbelievable how many girls were killed even before they were born. But also just the way in which in that society life became just an economic value. And for instance, handicapped children that were born with either physical or mental handicap, they were often killed. Or they were not; they didn't receive medical treatment because the parents were like, "Well, perhaps he or she will die, and then we can get another child." Things like that, you know. It's big scale destruction of life, and Paul VI warned against that. And I think those are realities of the world in which we live, and we may not be aware of that because you know it's not something that we want to dwell upon. We don't want to. We just want to live our lives the way we like it. And, you know, these things bother us and also sometimes show us a mirror and ask us to change our lifestyle. And a lot of people don't like that. But I think, you know, our quest for the truth and our obligation to seek the truth in everything shouldn't stop us from examining this and thinking about this and sometimes also rethinking the laws in our countries, the way in which we behave. And it's not just because something is allowed legally by human laws that is morally that it's morally allowed. I think as Catholics, as Christians, we have higher standards and higher moral requirements to adhere to than just, you know, follow whatever is current in our countries. So, but for me, it goes way beyond that one encyclical letter. Another one that is really worth reading and still super topical in a way and current in its themes is Evangelii Nuntiandi, on proclaiming the gospel, in which Paul VI says the church itself has a constant need of being evangelized. And the people today listen more willingly to witnesses than to teachers. And if he does listen to teachers, it is because they are witnesses. That is so true. And how do you dialogue with the world around you? It's not just by preaching. It's by witnessing. It's not just by faring a culture war. It's by changing the culture, by changing yourself first as a church, as a Christian. And he continues in that same encyclical letter, the world calls for and expects from us a simplicity of life, the spirit of prayer, charity towards all, especially towards the lowly and the poor, obedience and humility, detachment and self-sacrifice. Without this mark of holiness, our word will have difficulty in touching the heart of modern man. It risks being vain and sterile, Paul wrote. How true is that, and how much have we seen the consequences of a life opposite to these values in the abuse crisis? And one of the reasons that our current Pope Francis is warning against the danger of clericalism is exactly this. It's when people that have an appointment in the church as a shepherd that are called to serve the people of God, instead of serving like Christ did, are letting themselves being served and using other people for their own well-being, their own comfort, their own desires. That leads to horrible consequences sometimes. So, but it was Paul VI who was already calling the church to live a different lifestyle and telling us basically it's okay to preach the gospel, but if, you know, only use words if necessary. Show it by living the way Jesus lived. And if you do that, then living out the gospel will not be without fruit. It's time to go over to the world of technology.
We are on the cutting edge of technology.
Wow. Well, what does that mean?
Let's plug it in. It's going to say, hey, I see you plugged in a new device. And it's going to load in the appropriate drivers. You'll notice that this scanner built... Whoa.
Well, all your technology stuff, it just ends in disaster.
But there is one more thing.
I just recently plugged in a new device in my home system, and that was a third Google Home Mini. In their most recent presentation, Google announced that the Google Home gear, because it's equipment, would be available in more countries than before, and one of those countries is the Netherlands. And I think it's on October the 24th that the Google Home and the Google Home Mini are officially introduced in our country, which also means that Google has worked a lot on the comprehension of the Dutch language, which is kind of hard because Dutch sounds like Klingon. And it's not an easy language to master and to recognize because of all the guttural sounds in it. But they've made great progress with the language of Dutch. And so they feel confident enough that the voice recognition has evolved enough to introduce these devices in the Netherlands. What nobody knows here in the Netherlands, but what I have discovered is that it is already operational and that Google Home now allows you to speak to those devices and to the Google Home app on your phone in two languages at once.
Is one of my frustrations is knowing several languages is when I'm typing an email on my phone, I have to make sure that the phone is set to the language in which I'm typing, especially in iOS. In iOS, I really have to make sure that it's set to English when I'm typing English. Otherwise, I'm just typing away and I'm not looking because I'm, you know, typing quite quickly. And then I notice, well, trying to type something in English, but it's set to Dutch. So it's thinking I'm typing Dutch and it's doing autocorrect on all that English. It's so unnecessary because the computer should be able to understand from after three words that I'm typing something in Dutch and not in English, or the other way around. But in iOS, that's doesn't work. Google has made it possible to type on Android, for instance, in two languages, and eventually perhaps even any language. And the same is true for the Google Home system. And so it was a simple matter of choosing a secondary language, and now all of a sudden my Google Home speaks Dutch. And it's so cool. The only thing that I haven't figured out yet, and perhaps it's not possible, is to how to set the voice, the type of voice, for the secondary language. For the English voice, I can pick, I think, between 8 different voices. Half of them male, other half female. Some of them sound really very, very human. For the Dutch voice, it's still this kind of a little bit of a robotic Dutch voice that I also have on my phone when I'm using Google Maps for navigation. And I usually have Google navigation set to English because I really don't like the Dutch voice. The Dutch voice sounds like a very strict school teacher, female school teacher, who is always talking down to you. It's like, you turned right. Try to turn around. It's like... If you do that one more time, I will stop the car. I will crash you into a tree. So make sure you always obey me. She has this very obnoxious voice. And I'm not the only one, actually, who says that. There wasn't someone else that I didn't know. I didn't know. So we were talking about Google Maps, and then the other person said, oh, with that terrible Dutch voice of that, she's always the strict lady. And I was like, yeah, exactly. That's how I feel too. So I'm not the only person who is struggling with that strict voice. But anyway, it's very cool to be able to say, you know, in Dutch, wat voor weer wordt het vandaag? Or in English, what's the weather going to be today? Or set a timer for 5 minutes. Waarschuw me over 5 minuten. I have the feeling that it understands a little bit less than it does in English. But since they're using a lot of machine learning, it's probably because it's not used that much yet in the Netherlands. So over time, it will probably recognize things much, much better. I've also discovered how to activate it. They've got a new app for the Google Home system, which is compatible with way more gear than ever before. And I'm actually already researching the Philips Hue lamps for my new rectory, because one of the downsides of living in that rectory and working here in the studio in my current rectory is that I will be away from home quite a bit because I'll be working here during the day and only get back home in the evening. Same thing when I'm, you know, celebrating Mass in one of the other parish churches. I'm away from home for a while. And of course, I don't want to give the impression that the building is empty and because, well, you know, people break in. So I know that with Philips Hue lamps, you can actually use it in conjunction with Google Home. And even they have like proximity sensors. So it knows when you're home and it will light up the lamps and it will fire up the heating. But you can also set it, program it to time, you know, say, well, hey, do the lights in the living room, turn them on at sunset, and then turn on the lights in the bedroom 2 hours later. And so you can program it in such a way that it looks as if someone is home. And of course, you can do that with old-fashioned timers as well, but it's much more fun and much more versatile to do that with these Google Home devices. Not to mention that you can also override it with your app no matter where you are in the world. And I'm looking, for instance, at the heating system, Nest system, which is a regulator for a climate regulator in your home that you can also activate and control when you're on vacation, for instance. I know that there are these doorbells with cameras that you can answer on your phone, and it doesn't matter where you are. If I'm vacationing on the moon, sipping from my 80 degrees Celsius coffee, blech, and someone rings my doorbell at the rectory in Hooglander Veen, I'd be able to answer the call on my phone. How cool would that be? So, great times. The only thing I'm still waiting for, and Google, please make it so, is help us change the activation phrase. So right now, it's I need to find something else, otherwise all your Google devices are going to answer this. But it's okay, Humphrey. but instead of okay, Humphrey, I want to be able to do the Picard thing, and I want to say computer. I think Alexa is already allowing you to do that. And one of the reasons, not just that I want to geek out as a, you know, captain on the bridge of the Enterprise, but it's all, I noticed that my, I'm playing a lot of videos on my computer. And one of my Google Home Minis is located next to the computer. So whenever I watch something about the Google Home Mini system and people are demonstrating the functionality, my Google Home Mini is constantly being tricked into answering. And then it's like, well, I can't give you that information, or I don't understand what you're saying. That would change if I could teach it another activation phrase. You know, it could be anything. But that would solve, I think, the problem. And I know that they want you to say, okay, Humphrey, because it, you know, it's the brand name. But it doesn't make sense in terms of usability. It's much easier. Even a dog, you can teach a dog another name. If you keep calling your dog instead of, I don't know, Buddy, you call it Shakespeare. You do that for a year, the dog will answer to Shakespeare. So why is my Google Home Mini stupider than a dog? It's not supposed to be like that, Google. So make it so. Anyway, I'm not in charge of Google, and that's a good thing. So that was very, very cool technology. Speaking of the rectory, the new rectory, since I have to wait until the 1st of November to move, because they're still currently painting the walls, I'm also thinking of how to decorate the home, because I won't have that much. I'm filling 10 boxes and that's it. And a little bit of furniture. And most of the IKEA stuff will stay here for the studio, for Tridio. So what am I going to put in those rooms? And I want to become more creative. Why not create my own art? Art. I'm not very good at painting or anything. But what I would like to do is to create, you know, to theme every room. And I already know the room where I'm going to write, where I'm going to read and study. That's going to be my Hobbit room. And I want to create Hobbity stuff, you know. So I'm going to do some research and try to fabricate my own Hobbit decorations. But I want to do the same, but differently in the downstairs room. And I'm thinking of a Harry Potter theme. So I want to create a Harry Potter themed main living room. And I'm still trying to think about other themes. Of course, everybody tells me, of course, you're going to have a Star Wars room. But then I'm thinking, yeah, well, what is a Star Wars room? What should that look like? I'm not going to do the bridge of a Star Destroyer. I mean, if there is one thing that the Empire doesn't have, it's taste for interior decoration. It's really ugly and stark. And so I don't want to create an Ewok room either. So what is a Star Wars style? I don't know. It's much easier to pick something like Tolkien or Harry Potter, because that's defined, or even Game of Thrones. But then I'm thinking Game of Thrones, and that's 2019 is going to be the last season, and then it's going to be over. So it may not be the best style. What else? Star Trek. Star Trek is a more consistent style. You know, if you look at, well, of course, with Discovery, it's changing. And Discovery, in many ways, doesn't look at all like classic Star Trek. But there is a bit of a Star Trek look. But even then, you'd probably have to pick something like, I'm going to do Next Generation or I'm going to do Deep Space Nine style. And I don't know if in a classic, you know, it's a 100-year-old rectory, that I want to do something futuristic. I may actually want to pick something that's more retro. Perhaps I should do a Charles Dickens room, or I don't know. Let me know if you have any ideas. I'm just blanking out there. Like, I've got two or three more rooms that I want to style in a certain style. Perhaps I should pick a video game? I don't know. Let me know if you have any ideas. And if you have any, you know, experience with fabricating your own decorations for interior design, let me know as well. I'm always open for new ideas. And with that, it is time to wrap things up here on my weekly show. Thanks to all my patrons over at patreon.com/FatherRoderick. You're helping me doing this without any advertisements. And that is not just benefiting you, it's also helping all the other listeners. And as a thank you, make sure to check out my weekly after show on the Patreon website. There are instructions on Patreon itself on how to subscribe to that. I'll see you soon. Take care and God bless.